We do not teach on these subjects just because they're interesting, as I've been saying. I find it very satisfying to prove up the validity of God's Word and His view of things. Obviously, the pyramid was built by men of superior intelligence, if they were men. Obviously, Stonehenge was built by men of superior intelligence. And its link up to the pyramid and to Jerusalem is mind-boggling. Now, Atlantis. I'm going to read the opening lines of this book again, and then skip on over to where we left off. The Stones of Atlantis by Dr. David Zink. Late one evening in 1975, I sat by myself, lost in thought in Brown's Bar, on North Bimini Island. How, I wondered, could an English professor like myself have gotten so far afield from Victorian literature as to pursue Atlantis as a serious archaeological possibility? A decade ago, few people, myself least of all, would have suggested that I would become involved in such a quest, an expedition, looking for remnants of Atlantis. To have anticipated several actual expeditions, several of them, within the Bermuda Triangle would have been even more far-fetched. Under 17 feet of water, just 3 miles from where I sat in Brown's Bar, rested the mysterious stones which had once again brought me back to the Bahamas. I had returned for the second time more convinced than ever that these huge encrusted limestone blocks, now covered with the sea for at least 6,000 years, might possibly hold the key to an important chapter in prehistory. Were they, come over here, Peter, were they, as some people insisted, merely natural geological formations? Or could they be something altogether stranger and more significant? Perhaps even the remains of Atlantis or one of her colonies. I fervently hoped that the present expedition would penetrate the secrets of these cyclopean stones off Paradise Point. By now, whichever way it went, I wanted some answers. In a chartered boat, a rented Boston whaler, in February 1974, he had taken the first trip, running along the white beaches off the island of North Bimini. They were visiting what has come to be called the road site underwater, off Paradise Point. Now beneath these waters, such was its transparency, we saw glimpses of the huge blocks. Another explorer of these stones, Dr. Valentine, had called a megalithic site. Stunning in their size and obvious order, they could even be photographed from on deck through 18 feet of water. The overall order of these blocks was unmistakable, particularly from the air. But once diving, snorkeling underwater close up, this order disappeared, at least temporarily. The road site, which I ultimately came to regard as not a road at all, takes the form of a huge reversed letter J. Is what it looks like. That's underwater, friends. Taken from the air. A diagram showing the layout of the stones, upper half of the picture, Peter, is contained. After some discussion of megalithic sites and the discoveries in their first trip in 1974, he begins to talk about Stone Age computers. Because there is so little evidence about megalithic culture, every new site presents exciting possibilities, particularly when it is found on another continent. That's all I need from you, Peter. Why do you smoke cigars? You might say, I like them. It makes Jerry Falwell mad. That Robinson wouldn't grin as much if he'd smoke one. And there's nothing in the Bible that says I can't. My freedom stick. Just to prove you don't have to be a freak to be a Christian. You don't have to park your brain at the door of the church either. New Hampshire's Mystery Hill, once believed to have been built by a 19th century farmer, includes stones of over 6 tons that mark the summer and winter solstices. Dr. Barry Fell, professor of invertebrate zoology at Harvard University, and president of the Epigraphic Society, a group which examines and translates ancient stones, has translated inscriptions to the Celtic sun god Belos, or Baal, the chief deity of the Phoenicians, from a single stone at Mystery Hill. Now, you'll remember Barry Fell is the one who began to discover those strange writings of Celtic peoples that just look like lines in the rocks, proving the Celts were here long before Columbus, long before Leif Erikson, clear back to 500 B.C. And he translated from New Hampshire's Mystery Hill inscriptions to the Celtic sun god, Belos or Baal, the chief deity of the Phoenicians, from a single stone at Mystery Hill. This evidence strongly suggests the presence of two ancient cultures in America at least as far back as 800 B.C. The earliest occupancy of the site, based on a corrected carbon 14 date, may be as early as 2000 B.C. At present, the group exploring the site, the New England Antiquities Research Association, is at work on another site in Vermont that also allegedly abounds in Celtic artifacts and inscriptions. Megalithic structures share far more subtle features than large, heavy stones, however. For John Mitchell, today's most serious writer on the subject, has shown that prehistoric man, his temple and the cosmos were all felt to be parts of one life system. All true megalithic constructions, if he's right, that would include Stonehenge, he claims, are based on, quote, sacred engineering. not some caveman, frustrated because his wife had a headache, throwing rocks around. Sacred engineering. Thus, the code of a civilization, its spiritual awareness and technological harmony with the environment, were actually built into the structure, not plastered on later. The buildings contained measurements, these megalithic structures, that are now being decoded by gematria, the system of correspondences between numbers and letters. We saw some of that as we just scratched the surface in Stonehenge. The gematria of Holy of Holies and Holy being connected to the dimensions that are linked in the New Jerusalem and in the Holy of Holies of the Temple and Stonehenge. The gematria of Isaiah 19, totaling the exact number of inches from the base of the pyramid to the top of the summit platform. It's cold in here. That's gematria. The buildings contain measurements that are now being decoded by gematria, the system of correspondence between numbers and letters. Also discovered within these structures are geometrical and geodetic proportions, such as pi and phi, the golden section, an equivalence of the earth's rotation and the orientation of the site in relation to the stars, sun, and moon, other megalithic sites, such as the sighting in between the northwest station or marker stone and the southeast station or marker stone, and carry the line as a rum line across the Mediterranean, it hits the pyramid. So they don't stand alone. They bring the universe and its measurement, dimensions, sightings, and movements into the structure's measurements and orientation. They relate to the gematria of verses in God's book, names in God's book. Now, gematria applied to English is but parlor games. Gematria has no sense at all. You can't take the Arabic numbers and say A is number one and B is number two and apply gematria to the English language. It works only in those languages whose letters are numbers, like Hebrew and Greek and the ancient languages. And they interconnect to each other, showing a building society that crossed the globe, or a presence of an architect guiding the builders across the globe. The presence of such elements reflects the idea that the cosmic temple was a living organism with the capacity to resonate with all other living systems. This is truly an awesome idea whose implications take some time to grasp. You know the yin and yang of the ancient Chinese. You won't think it's so difficult to grasp. Do you understand the concept of the ancient ley lines that crisscross the globe? You will begin to understand why the most ancient cathedrals are built on certain alignments including the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau and Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Do you understand the works of Tesla? The entire globe is just one big conductor. Things are not as solid as they look to us. Next time you meet a neutron, ask him how he gets around through some of those crevices so easily. Crevices we don't see. Megalithic constructions, the expert named John, we met last night in the earlier chapter, that had joined him in his explorations off Paradise Point, megalithic constructions, John continued, invariably served a sacred function in the ancient world, the purpose of which was to integrate man with, rather than to isolate him from, his environment, to connect him simultaneously to the macrocosm of the stars and the microcosm of the atom. Maybe so, maybe no. The point is, it's like parapsychology, extrasensory perception. Those who study it no longer doubt its existence. That has ceased to be at issue to those that have taken their head out of the sand and paid attention to the scholarly work and controlled experiments in a couple of major universities in the United States. The issue is no longer, does parapsychology exist? The issue is how. The point of this man, John Mitchell's statement, all these megalithic constructions are interconnected. Not necessarily. Is this... Well, let me say a second thing. They're not only interconnected, they served a sacred function. But John hasn't necessarily defined what the sacred function is. He, like those who have quit questioning parapsychology and offer explanations of how, he has quit questioning, as anyone who studies it long enough will, that they're interconnected and that they served more than astronomical and computer functions regarding the stars and solstices and seasons. They had a sacred function. He's just offering his idea of what that sacred function was, to integrate man with, rather than to isolate him from his environment, to connect him simultaneously to the macrocosm of the stars and the microcosm of the atom. Now, there's a basis for his interpretation. His view is based on the Hermetic tradition, as above, so below, in quotes. In order to reconcile elements of the earth with the heavens, one needed the equivalent of a transformer, such as allows the output of an audio amplifier to be matched to a speaker system. As John Mitchell said in his book, City of Revelation, quote, the cosmic temple was an equilibrator whose function was to reconcile all the diverse and contradictory elements of nature. And that's getting pretty heavy. But let's keep going. During my first reading of Mitchell, I understood this in only a figurative or symbolic fashion. Gradually I began to realize that not only does mathematical order originate in nature, but that in some as yet unknown fashion, geometric shapes intensify and focus various subtle cosmic energies. Therefore, I was fascinated by the book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, by Schroeder and Ostrander, who relate that in the 1950s, a Frenchman named Bovis found small animal carcasses in a waste can within the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. They had been mummified and gave off no odor. Experiments in Europe eventually led to patented pyramid-shaped milk containers that retard spoilage, razor blade sharpeners, and other devices. I learned that a physicist friend had conducted extensive experiments in Houston, Texas, and found that even in the warm, moist climate of the Gulf Coast, creating a similar pyramid environment, fresh fish could similarly mummify. Clearly, the dry desert air of Giza was not the only factor at work. Many scientists have offered plausible explanation of techniques for moving the gigantic stones at Stonehenge, Easter Island, which we've not spent much time looking at yet. Those vast stone faces. And the pyramids stones. Many scientists have offered plausible explanations of techniques for moving the stones. And perhaps, this author says, with a large, well-organized society such as existed in Egypt, huge stones with weights ranging upwards to 1,000 tons in the case of the pink granite obelisk brought many miles down the Nile, perhaps these stones could be managed with the suggested techniques of many workers. But is it conceivable that a simple people could have used these more sophisticated methods? Even in Egyptian culture, we cannot account for the incredible precision with which many of the stones of the Great Pyramid are arranged. In the 1880s, one investigator applying precision instruments to some of the 15-ton casing stones he'd unearthed found that the average variation both from a straight line and a perfect square was only 1/100 of an inch in 75. This is the accuracy of skilled optics, not crude masonry. Work of this quality must be troublesome to those who still assert the ignorance of the primitive Egyptians. Writing in the 1960s, one particular commentator described, sounds like 6 o'clock news, described of Peter Tompkins in his book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid. One commentator in the 60s made the outrageous statement that the Egyptians were unaware of the cardinal points of the compass except for east and west, which they knew only from sunrises and sunsets. Yet they accomplished the building of the Great Pyramid. Later in experiments of my own, I discovered that a model pyramid large enough to contain a person and properly oriented to true north seemed to enhance the subject's alpha brainwave content and also stimulated several involuntary out-of-the-body experiences. You should read the experience. Napoleon, well, he never would tell anybody. He came out of spending a night in the king's chamber, blanched white, almost on St. Helena, told a person what his experience was, but then it died with him. And G.P. Morgan, in his description of spending a night in the king's chamber. In various attempts to probe the nature of the energy generated by a pyramid in relation to its orientation, I blindfolded a sensitive and had her tune the pyramids or the pyramid for maximum energy by rotating it. When the pyramid's side was aligned with true north, the psychic reported the maximum energy. Blindfolded. The energy output continued noticeably when the pyramid was within 10 degrees on either side of true north. Other blindfolded sensitives reported maximum energy above the apex of the pyramid. All of these clues should have helped me to understand Mitchell's term, equilibrator, as a scientific quantity, whether or not we presently have the science to understand it. In my research, I had discovered... Oh, this is boring. You want me to continue? I'm reading from the Stones of Atlantis with Dr. David Zink, and I'm not going to review. I'm going to pick up where I left off. In my research, I had discovered that early man was apparently capable of recognizing strong currents of magnetic energy at various points on the Earth's surface. From China to Britain, ancient architects employed sensitives known as geomancers to help locate their sacred structures at high magnetic energy points, where human activities would be in harmony with terrestrial currents. These power points, marked by standing stones and later often by churches, were connected by invisible lines of magnetic energy called Li or Ley lines. Today, a more comprehensive view of these energy patterns is emerging. By the way, here's a picture of an ancient Chinese geomancer's compass. Writing in the New Age Journal, November 5, 1975, Chris Bird, co-author with Peter Tompkins of The Secret Life of Plants, suggests that some scientists are now seriously entertaining the ancient notion of metaphysics that, quote, our earth and all matter upon it, whether held to be living or non-living, is but the final result of a transformation of energy. His article, Planetary Grid, summarizes several Russian theories about the existence of a global energy pattern. If they get that worked out ahead of us, that's more valuable than Star Wars.
This is the end of Side 1.